I'm here. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Deepest Lore. And much in the vein of my previous streams on the Wu-Tang Clan and the Residents, today I'm going to be flying solo as we dive into the deep, rich, huge back catalogue of Bob Dylan. Now, unlike Wu-Tang and the Residents, I'm not going to be able to play any music today because Dylan's record label is notoriously, and I mean that more than any other artist around, his record label are intensely hot on the old copyright law. And they have been for ages. You know, if you search YouTube, you won't be able to find most of Dylan's songs because they just nuke everything. So I'm not going to risk trying to play any Dylan. Okay, so let's get started then. Now, before I begin, a few things I want to mention. First, I'm going to try as best I can on this stream to give the non-Dylan fan or the newbie or someone who might be looking to get into Dylan a way in to appreciate and explore Dylan. But I also at the same time want to give people who may be, you know, fans of Dylan's or casual fans or even hardcore bobheads something extra as well. So I'm going to try to do both of those things at the same time. I'm going to try to give, I mean, I can imagine that there's, you know, a few Dylan obsessives out there who will learn nothing new whatsoever from this stream. But I suspect those people are few and far between. So I'm going to try to do both of those things at the same time by, you know, going into some of the deep cuts, digging into the bootleg series, giving you alternate versions where possible, and so on and so forth. So it's quite a tall order because that means essentially I am going to try to comment on Dylan's entire recorded output, which is absolutely massive. So to do that in 2 hours or so is going to be interesting. Now, there's a few kind of other things to mention before we get going here, just to kind of lay my cards on the table and tell you, you know, my views of about Bob Dylan up front. I actually consider Bob Dylan to be a great artist in the same sort of vein as William Shakespeare or Mozart or somebody on this sort of level, okay? You know, in the Civilization games where sometimes great artists are born in cities and you get that flashing light and you get a special unit, I see Bob Dylan as an artist on that sort of level, kind of, you know, a Dante. He's somebody, in my mind, that is easily, you know, in that category. And that is controversial because he's arguably, I mean, at least in my mind, the only person of that sort of stature to come out of what we could call popular culture. I was actually thinking about this the other day as to think, like, are there any film directors or other kind of pop artists or anything like that that I would put in that category? And I honestly think there are none that you'd put in that kind of, you know, all-time civilizational-wide sort of artist. Now, I can, you know, many people may disagree, but I have my own reasons for believing that Dylan is this sort of artist. One of the reasons for this is that much like with Shakespeare, there is something like all of life itself in Dylan somewhere. In all, you know, if you consider his entire body of work, I mean, he's basically got a song for every mood, for every occasion, for every emotion, and for emotions, moods, and occasions that you may not have experienced yet. So this is one of the things that as you get older, you start to appreciate songs that you didn't appreciate before. I mean, I can give you an example. Now I'm a father. I listen to Lord Protect My Child, which is basically an outtake track from Infidels yesterday with completely new eyes. You know, that he has much like, you know, serious artists on this level, he has different phases. He has different eras and periods in his career, which are all rich and deep and rewarding. And even in his bad, here's the interesting thing with Dylan. Even Dylan's like worst stuff, his worst periods, still have something interesting and important going on in them. So I mean, much like I mentioned, like, you know, there are like lesser Shakespeare plays as well, but even they have something to say, interesting to say about them. So yeah, so that's the first thing to mention, that I consider Dylan to be an artist in that bracket. You know, when he was given the Nobel Prize a few years back, I know some people were sniffy about it, but I thought that was entirely misplaced. I mean, I'd have to think about this, but arguably he is the only artist of that caliber that has been produced by America as a country. I'd have to think about that, but I can't really think of any other American artist specifically. And there's a reason. You know, when I said there's something like all of life in Dylan, there is also all of America, American history, American culture, American towns, not just New York and LA, but all the little towns in between. You know, we'll get into why that is. The other thing I'll say is that one of the problems with non-fans trying to approach Dylan is the problem actually of some of the mystique around him and some of the kind of critical hype around him, which can, you know, can seem very pretentious from the outside. This is not his fault, though. This is not Dylan's fault. I do think there's a problem that arose where, because Dylan is this great artist and a great poet and so on, there was this move for professors, like literary professors, to come to write books on Dylan, where they tried to consider him alongside Keats and Yeats and, you know, T.S. Eliot. And this is entirely the wrong way. To treat Dylan like a literary figure is to misunderstand Dylan, because you don't need to know much about him to know that his burning passion, what he lives for, from the, you know, from literally the age of when he was a teenager to now, is the American songbook, whether it's the folk songbook, whether it's the blues, whether it's gospel, whether it's the old standards written by likes of Irving Berlin and Cole Porter and all the rest of it. This is what Dylan lives and breathes. You know, going forward, whether it's Elvis, you know, rockabilly, you name it, he is like a walking encyclopedia of all of that, then infused with the wider mythology of what America is, the wide open road, the dust bowl, it's kind of rural history. So all of these things, I would say, I mean, in my mind, he's the closest thing that America have and probably ever will have to being like a kind of national bardic figure, a little bit like the way Shakespeare is for Britain. Or you could name other important writers from other countries. He's in that sort of bracket. I mean, some of the Russian writers play that function for Russia. I think Dylan plays that function for America. So, yes. The other thing I want to say before I get going on this, I don't want to make this monologue too long at the start here, is that there are a number of entry barriers for getting into Dylan, okay? Entry barriers. The first entry barrier is that Dylan does not have a conventional voice. He's not a crooner like a Frank Sinatra who's got a velvety vocal tone, and he's not got a conventional rock voice either. David Bowie famously described his him having a voice of sand and glue. But, you know, he's nasal, he's snarling, and a lot of people, you know, find this difficult to adjust to. And so there is unlike, say, the Beatles, where you can just whack in Sergeant Pepper and you'd be like, oh, this is a nice tune. Dylan's not like that. He takes some adjustment. He takes some getting into. You may not actually, you know, confront an album of his and get into it straight away. It may take time. I mean, certainly when I was a teenager first getting into Dylan, obviously I'd read Around, and then I started to listen. I was like, I'm not sure I can do this. Like, this harmonica everywhere seems kind of grating, and you know, it's a very different vibe to most stuff that you're used to listening to. All of a sudden something clicks. Something really clicks with you. And I remember the exact moment where Dylan clicked with me. I had this old Nissan Micra when I was 17, little white car, old banger it was. I can't remember what happened to that car. I think it got like hot wired or something. But anyway, I happened to have the essential Bob Dylan CD. I thought, right, let's give this another whirl. At the time, I was obsessed with David Bowie, and maybe one day I'll do another stream on Bowie. He's kind of like, if I have two like twin loves in music, it would be Dylan and Bowie. I mean, there are other artists that I like and appreciate, but I would say that far and away, Dylan easily is the only artist of that caliber. You know, Bowie is in. Bowie's like an icon, and he's got some great albums and stuff. I wouldn't say Bowie is like a kind of country defining, genre defining, you know, epochal kind of artist in the same way that Dylan is. Great though Bowie is. So I would say, like, you know, if I was to make my top 10 or top 100 artists, there'd be everybody. And then like it's some way, it's not even close, you know, some way there'd be like its own island. With Dylan as its own thing over there, and I think people who are really into Dylan feel that way, so I would say there are two types of Dylan fans in a way. There are those Dylan fans who, you know, would appreciate everything I'm saying, and then there are Dylan fans who just have Dylan alongside everybody else that they like. You know, oh, I like this album, but I also like The Who. You know, I would say those people are. Not the true Bob heads, if that makes any sense. I was driving. I put this essential Bob Dylan CD I had into my Nissan Micra at the time. In fact, I think at that time that Nissan Micra didn't have a built-in CD, and I had like this Sony Walkman that I'd somehow like plugged in. You know, I got it playing on the speaker somehow, but. You know, it was not actually part of the car. Anyway, that was it. Sorry. Yes. I don't know if anybody remembers this, but you could have a tape that would go into an old, if you remember, cars had tape, cassette tape, insert, and you could get these tapes which had a kind of audio kind of jack lead in, and you could put one jack lead into your like Sony Discman, and you could put the other jack into that tape, and then it would play over the speakers. This is the sort of things we had to do back then. Anyway, the song that came on was "It's All Right, Ma" from Bringing It All Back Home, which, if anybody knows it, you know, is a kind of real verbal barrage of, you know, imagery that piles up, and it kind of, you know, it's talking about how most people in culture are, you know, kind of brainwashed in a way, and it's talking about advertising, and it just talks about everything and everything. I remember the moment that it was almost like a kind of religious conversion, and from that moment on, I knew basically Dylan was going to be, you know, something important. And from that moment, being, you know, the way I am, I collected all of the albums. I would say, by the way, I'm going to be mentioning a lot of music, and you know, to buy it all would cost many thousands of pounds, which I did spend back in the day. I remember, back then I had to save up money and go to like a Virgin Megastore and wait until they had their 4 for £20 sales and things like that to slowly but surely build up my collection. But these days you can just join one of these sites. I'm a member of this thing called Amazon Music. And Amazon Music has literally everything, including like the bootleg series and the live albums. I mean, it's got everything on there. In fact, the only thing I saw it didn't have was this little album called Sidetracks, which I'll tell you about. Like I said, for the Dylan enthusiast, I'm going to be sprinkling in these kind of advanced recommendations. But there's an album called Sidetracks that came out when I think it was released in Japan, but then they re-released it when they did this thing called the Copyright Extension Collection or something. And this album called Sidetracks came out. In fact, I think even Sidetracks is on the Amazon Prime. Yeah, if you join Amazon Unlimited on Prime, even Sidetracks is on there. I'm looking at it now. And Sidetracks basically collects all of those singles and little B-sides and things that weren't on albums. It's like a kind of odds and ends collection, but it's very, very handy because they're all in one place. It's got little things like, I mean, there's an amazing version of Isis from Desire, from, I think it's from the Montreal Forum. It's the one where he thanks Leonard Cohen. He kind of dedicates the song to Leonard Cohen at the start. And for me, that's the definitive version of Isis. And lo and behold, it's on Sidetracks. So Sidetracks is very, very handy for, you know, for collecting a lot of that sort of material. Anyway, when it clicks, but it can be a curve. There are other artists who have this sort of curve. I mean, Tom Waits has a curve. Lou Reed has a curve. Anybody really who has this kind of unconventional stylings. I mean, in a way, the Smiths have a curve. But I would say Dylan does have that barrier to entry. The second barrier, and I will say, by the way, that the idea that Dylan can't sing is stupid, okay? He doesn't have a great conventional voice. But what he does have is dynamic and engaging performance and emotion and an ability to kind of attack his lines and to deliver his lines in such a way that really brings them into life and into focus. I a lot of people talk about the late, you know, Dylan since about 2000, where his voice is all kind of cracked and gnarled and grisly, you know. I actually think that that's his best voice. So we'll get onto that when we come to, I mean, I think Dylan, the old man Dylan, is possibly his ultimate form. It's almost like that's the person he always wanted to be. But anyway, we'll get to that when we come to it. The other massive entry barrier to Dylan, of course, is that he just has so many albums and songs. I mean, I think there are, he's written over 1,000 songs. What is it? It's more than 35 albums now, because there was that Rough and Rowdy Ways that came out. In how many studio albums has he had? 39 studio albums. Rough and Rowdy Way was the 39th studio album. Plus, you know, at least 15 volumes of the bootleg series, which are all, I mean, they're not all essential, but there's some really essential material in the bootleg series, plus tons of compilations and live albums and all the rest of it. So, yeah, that's a big entry barrier too, because people are like, well, you know, where can I start? And there are those people. I can see somebody in the chat saying you just need the 60s albums. Absolute nonsense. Some of his best material is after the 60s. He has some tremendous work past then. So that I would say is a view that I would like to dispense with entirely. Basically, I just think that's a worthless view. I'll get on to why in a second. So bearing in mind, I realize there may be complete beginners here. One of the questions will be, well, where do I start with all of this? And there are a number of different ways you could start, right? One way to start is just right at the beginning. Start with Bob Dylan from 1962 and work forwards if you're going to just be a completionist. Or you can start with what is considered his, typically considered his best stuff, which is the Holy Trilogy of Bring It All Back Home, Highway 61 and Blonde on Blonde from the mid-60s. Or you could start in the 70s with Blood on the Tracks, because it's a very accessible album, also a great place to start. Or if you're someone who's like only listened to the 60s albums and you're not sure what to do next, or if you haven't listened to any Edda Dylan really, I'd give Love and Theft a whirl from 2001, which is masterpiece if you ask me. All right, so how am I going to do this? So I've got what I've got open here is Bob Dylan's official album, his official site here, and this is a pretty handy site because I was thinking, well, should I put kind of a PDF together with all his covers? But I thought, well, look, it's here. And this is very handy because you can filter them. Look, I can show you the studio albums, the bootleg series, compilations. It's all, or I can put them chronologically. So let's make a start because there are 40 albums plus to get through here and limited time. So, yeah. The last thing I'll mention before we start, and I promise this is the last thing, is that just to give you a kind of brief overview, there are a number of kind of different periods of Dylan, okay? I'll just kind of give you a very, very quick rundown of the trajectory, I guess, of the different eras. So obviously this first album here is where he's very young, but then you have basically what you'd call his folk or protest period. This is when he was strongly identified with the counterculture, and he played famously in Washington when Martin Luther King gave that speech, and he was kind of seen as a spokesperson of a generation, and he was very young at this period, and I'll say more about that in a sec. In a strange way, even though that is still something for which Dylan is famous, in a way, it was never a mantle he was comfortable with. And realistically, he wasn't political in the way that a lot of the other protest singers were at that period, like Pete Seeger. Or Dylan was not a kind of doctrinaire, he wasn't like a communist or like a doctrinaire leftist or anything like that. he was just really into folk and happened to be in that scene at that time. I mean, he's got one song that is overtly political, I would say, from that period, called I think it was meant to be on this on Freewheeling, called Talking John Birch Blues, where he takes aim at the John Birch Society, which some people will know about. He actually names George Lincoln Rockwell in that song. Basically, that's a song where he's kind of making fun of John Birch Society members for looking for communists everywhere because they were paranoid that there was a communist takeover of the country. That's about as political as, you know, as kind of overtly political as Dylan gets in this early period here. And again, there's a humor. It's always cast in this satirical mode, unlike some of the other guys in that period who are a bit preachy and they're a bit kind of holier than thou. That's never a kind of mask that Dylan was happy with. And I'll talk more about that when I get to another side of Bob Dylan, because he quite clearly turns his back on that entire crowd. You know, there are some famous events that happen where he's accused of betraying the scene, and, you know, he goes electric. But anyway, when he does go electric, he does it on this album, on Bringing It All Back Home, which is half acoustic and then the second half, you know, is electric. And these three albums here, Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61 Revisited, and Blonde on Blonde, are, you know, you could loosely say the Holy Trilogy. They're almost always given 5 stars in every publication. You know, you'll see them all three of these albums listed at the top of, you know, top 100 album lists, and, you know, album of the millennium lists and things like that. And they are fantastic albums. So this little period here, this is probably where Dylan was at the peak of his kind of, I guess, fame and coolness. And, you know, he was kind of a hipster poet during this period. You know, he was probably taking a few substances around this time as well. And he's markedly more kind of cynical and caustic and at times openly nasty on some of these albums as well. And this is something else that you'll get with Dylan that you don't really get. He'll show you every side of life, you know, even the ugly parts. He's sometimes angry. He's sometimes paranoid. He's sometimes, you know, and then in other moments he can be tender and he can be sweet and he can be funny. And, you know, he also has this capacity to come across almost like a prophet in certain moments as well. There's a song on Bringing It All Back Home, for example, called Gates of Eden, where he sounds like he's from a different time. Could be like a 19th century kind of, or even like earlier, you know, 16th century wandering minstrel that's come in from a different planet. So he does have this otherworldly quality occasionally as well. So this is one era, the folk era. Then you have this kind of hipster poet, kind of cool era here. In 1967, he has a motorcycle accident, and he kind of had to disappear for a while. They put out this greatest hits collection while he was recuperating. And famously, Dylan withdrew to some kind of rural retreat while he was recovering from this motorcycle accident, and embarks on a series of much quieter, kind of country-tinged albums, starting with John Wesley Harding, masterpiece in its own right, and then Nashville Skyline, which is even more country, Self-Portrait, which is arguably his first, like, not that good album, and then New Morning, which is basically like him moving to a farm with his family and wanting to be left alone. And this period, this quiet retreat period, ends with Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits 2, which actually has about 4 or 5 songs that were recorded just for that on it. And again, if you get that sidetracks I mentioned, they're all on there. It's things like I Shall Be Released and what else was on there? Yeah, You Ain't Going Nowhere, Crash On That, like these songs here are all only found on Greatest Hits 2. Okay. Sorry, I didn't actually open it. Yeah, you see these songs here from 8 to 12, I think they were just recorded just for that, just for this Greatest Hits. So that's a kind of hidden little mini album there at the end. You can find it on Sidetracks, or you can just pick up that, I suppose. Okay, so that's the end of that period. Then you have this, I'm not really a fan of this little period here. He kind of goes on, he kind of hooks up with these, with the band. I'm not a great fan of the band, personally. Yeah, he hooks up with a band, he goes on tour, he does like a soundtrack, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. He changes a record label, and his old record label put out this album, Dylan, as a punishment. And it is shite. I'm not really a fan of this little period here. Planet Waves is probably, you know, I'm not that keen on that. Then he has his 70s trilogy, kind of real return to form with Blood on the Tracks. Again, you'll see this listed in top 100 albums and so on. Then you get Desire and Street Legal, another trilogy of fantastic. So you could say he's got his 60s trilogy. He's got his 70s trilogy here. They also released the Basement Tapes, but that was actually released in 1967. Okay. So I hope you're counting the eras at home. Yeah. So this is the 70s trilogy here. He goes on he gets divorced from his first wife, I think it's, what's her name? Suze. You know, they get married, they move to a farm. You know, he wants to kind of have a domestic idyll, but then he basically goes on this big tour, ends up falling out, gets divorced, puts out this kind of bittersweet album, Blood on the Tracks, which is all about his breakup. Then when he does Desire, he goes on a mad tour called Rolling Thunder Review, which was almost like a kind of traveling circus, and it's absolutely wild. Desire's kind of thrusting, adventurous spirit about it. Then there's Street Legal, which are kind of, you see some like gospel influence emerging on Street Legal. Then stunning everybody and pissing off the critics, he then converts to Christianity and puts out a series of evangelical Christian albums, starting with Slow Train Coming in 1979, then Saved, then Shot of Love. And this period here, I think in starting in 1979, he actually started refusing to play any of his old songs. He would only play like religious songs, Christian songs originally. But I think as this period where, you know, he kind of goes back on that, by the end of this period, I'll talk more, you know, when I start going through the albums, I'll talk more about what I think of each of these eras. But yeah, so it should be noted that by this point, he pissed off critics here and people wrote him off there. They said this in 1964, 65, people said, you know, he's betrayed folk and, you know, he's never going to be the same. People were pissed off here when he brought out this country album, Nashville Skyline. That kind of bewildered and annoyed critics because they wanted him to do more blonde on blonde stuff. And then again, he was like, oh, Dylan's back with Blood on the Tracks. I'm talking about the kind of Rolling Stone types, you know, or the kind of rock journos who were around at that time. And then again with his conversion here. He pissed a lot of people off as well. One thing I should mention as well is that Dylan is very notable for, from the very start of his career onwards, absolutely hating the media, being very hostile to journalists in interviews. He has never had any time whatsoever for the media. And at the same time, he seems to have a deep disdain for academia as well, which is something we'll get onto. But you know, I think there's a song on New Morning called Day of the Locusts, where he's invited to Princeton University to pick up a to pick up an honorary degree, and he's got nothing but utter contempt for the kind of professors and you know, the graduates, and he hates critics and journalists and the media in general. And I think there's an interesting strain of anti-establishment and anti-intellectualism in Dylan that I think that his commentators have never quite truly understood. And he always says it to them. He always says, you don't really understand what you're talking about when you're trying to put all these labels on me, when you're trying to say that my songs are about this and that. So this is another thing that I think continually pisses him off, that critics are always trying to like claim him for this thing or that thing, he's never really shown any interest in them. I think part of the reason is that he lived through many times where they were actively hostile to him, and so he kind of learned through experience as well. But he's, as far as I know, he's never changed that attitude. He has done a few interviews over the years. Did a long one in 2004, I seem to remember, with 60 Minutes. But generally, he's been very reclusive and reluctant to, to do much media. He's always uncomfortable in front of the camera. Even in his music videos, that comes across that he'd rather not be there. So, anyway, with Infidels in 1983. He, like the music press saw this as a massive return to secularism and, you know, political themes and so on. I'm not sure if I see that necessarily. I don't think Dylan ever really kind of deconverts. Like, too much was made, I think, of him being secular Bob again. In fact, even before Slow Train Coming, there are very strong biblical themes right through his works. And anecdotally, there are stories of him as early as 1965 having a massive Bible on his table, always opened, in the Old Testament. And he was apparently obsessed with it even back then. So friends of his said, well, he was kind of nominally Christian even back in the 60s. This kind of theme never goes away. If anything, just reading between the lines, I think Dylan got turned off by some aspects of the evangelical church that he was part of. And, you know, he never kind of comes out and renounces it, but I get the impression that he becomes closer. Hold on a second. He becomes closer. Just give me 1 minute. Right, sorry, Daddy's not happy. All right, so where was I? Yeah, I mean, on the Christian question, I don't really think that he ever gives up the idea of God at any point, all the way through to his later stuff. He's always attracted to the more kind of tub thumping kind of Old Testament, blood and fury, fiery type religion, and a kind of more vengeful God, I guess. But this never really goes away. And it, just reading between the lines, and I when I was preparing for this stream, I went back and looked over a few old interviews and things. The impression I get is that he does develop a kind of, I wouldn't put him in the same tradition as the perennial traditionalists, of course, but I think he develops his own sort of version that there's a higher animating spirit. I'm not sure if he has any particular church or denomination, but he seems to come to this understanding that there's something higher there. But again, he talks more about it being the songs and it coming through him. You know, he always talks about his songs as coming almost like coming from above, and he's just a conduit for the songs, if that makes any sense. And I think that Dylan, like, to the extent that Dylan has a religion, it seems to be deeply imbued with this idea that he's receiving, you know, he's receiving something, you know, from a higher animating spirit, and, you know, he's just a conduit for whatever it is. He also seems to have this idea that he's like, I don't know, like that it's his calling in life, basically, to never stop touring. Now, he's been on tour, I think, since, like, continuously since 1989. In fact, I think the pandemic was probably the biggest break he's had from touring since the 80s. I think they call it the never-ending tour. I mean, it's insane. Like, he's if you have a look at his touring dates, he's played hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dates. In fact, you can see it on this, because hold on, if you go to his song catalog here, there's a way of, hopefully you guys can all hear me. Can you all hear me? Yes, you can all hear me. Yeah, so you can actually see the number of times, because, you know, Bob Dylan's fans are extremely obsessive, and they count the amount of times that he's played certain songs. I mean, you could take this song here, right, from Time Out of Mind. He wrote Lovesick in 1997. He's played it 914 times in the past 20 years. You know, this song, Summer Days from Love and Theft, 2001 it came out. He's played it 885 times. These are real dates, real constant, real gigs he's done. So this is, you know, he has never stopped. You know, all these Love and Theft ones, you know, 700 times. This is some interesting details. In fact, Dylan, you know, famously in his backstory, ran away from home because he wanted to go and find his hero, Woody Guthrie. So in a strange way, he's constantly been on the road in one form or another since he was about 16. He's just turned 80. So this means that he's lived a very, you know, kind of a unique life, because not many people have spent that long, you know, traveling from town to town, you know, from venue to venue, you know, basically perennially. So this is the life that he's chosen for himself, but he describes it in terms of manifest destiny, coming back to the religion. Anyway, so yeah, we have this this period here, which kind of ends with Infidels. And then we have probably Dylan's lowest period in terms of his, you know, the albums, and in terms of his, he seemed to be kind of creatively spent during this period. I think the Christian period re-energizes him, and there are some fantastic live shows from 1981 where you can really hear that he's full of, like, verve and vigor. For some reason, he feels very adrift, starting with Empire Burlesque, Knocked Out Loaded, Down in the Groove. And if I was to say, like, what's the worst period of Dylan's career, it's this period here. You know, he just wasn't in a good place, it seems, during this whole stretch. And then a kind of return to form then is Oh Mercy, which is a great album. He brings in this producer, what's his name, Daniel Lanois, is that right? Who, you know, gives the whole thing a kind of ethereal sound. You know, Under the Beds guy's all right. Then he really goes back to roots with these two albums here, Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong, where he's going back and he's rediscovering all of his, you know, Delta Blues stuff that he loves, and going back to ancient, you know, folk songs and obscure acts like the Mississippi Sheiks and people like this. And kind of, I don't know, it seems like a bit of soul searching. And I think these are two great, great albums myself. I think, famously or infamously, he recorded one of these on just a cassette tape. And the studio wanted, they wanted an album from him. And he just turned up one day with this cassette tape and he'd done it himself. The sound quality is kind of interesting on these albums as well. But this is, I think, an important part of his journey here, because this will become important when we get to Love and Theft in a second. Then Time Out of Mind, where I think this Lenoir character comes back. Again, the kind of interesting, kind of muddy production on Time Out of Mind, where Dylan sounds kind of ghostly. I think he got ill around this time and he thought he was going to die. He was like in hospital and things. So that's a kind of very ghostly album, but again, typically given 5 stars. And again, this was hailed as a massive return to form as well, since Oh Mercy. And then, although if you ask me, these albums are very good in the middle as well. And then with Love and Theft, he grew this kind of thin Vincent Price-like moustache that you can see on the cover and started wearing like all white, almost like kind of Colonel Sanders, kind of Southern man type clothes. And I think it's with this album onwards, he develops a new way. He starts producing himself under the name of Jack Frost. And in some ways, this is the issue that he'd had really since the 70s, where he was struggling to find a producer or a style of recording that could really capture what he wanted in the studio. And he developed this way of recording with Love and Theft, where he basically had a live band playing with him all into the same mic, if that makes any sense. This is kind of Dylan's production method. They all play into the same mic. And so there's a very distinctive sound that he develops here on Love and Theft, which, again, if you ask me, is a masterpiece that I hold against anything that he made in the 60s or 70s, to be honest. In fact, I find myself going to Love and Theft more than I do some of the earlier albums these days, because there's so much on it. And then Modern Times is much in the same vein. As critics are wont to do, you'll see critics do this a lot. They do it so much. They kind of like, there were some critics who were all over Love and Theft and Time Out of Mind, but some of them also missed the boat on Love and Theft. They like kind of, they didn't really get it when it came out. So there was almost an overcompensation for that when Modern Times came out, which was then like massively praised across the board. You see that happen a lot, actually, where the critics miss a boat and then they try to overcompensate with the next album. I remember they did it with Oasis, actually. A lot of the music press kind of missed the boat on Oasis, and then when they came out with their third album, they all gave it like 5 stars and it was shite. Modern Times is good, by the way. I'm just saying that. That's what I think happened at that time. There was Together Through Life, which was these kind of form a trilogy, I would say. Together Through Life, Modern Times, and Love and Theft. Kind of Dylan is much more kind of grizzled and wily, and he's like an old veteran, telling jokes, and he's got a very distinctive character. But I always think that this is the singer that Dylan wanted to be. The singer on Love and Theft is who he had in mind that he wanted to be when he was young. Then he does this Christmas album, which was kind of a bit of a joke, but I remember when it came out, everyone was like, what? It's actually quite funny. And then Tempest came out in 2012, which was a much more kind of, I don't know, like a nastier album, bit of anger and a bit of vim and fire back. There's some really cracking tracks on there. Pay in Blood springs to mind. And then you get to this late period where he made 3 albums in a row of American standards, American from the Great American Songbook, that had all been all of these songs, apart from one, I think, had been done by Frank Sinatra. I wasn't that into these albums, to be honest. So I need to explore them a bit more. But I think this was Dylan again. Like, he goes through these little periods where he needs to get in touch with something. He needs to find inspiration somewhere. So much like he did with World Gone Wrong and Good As I've Been to You, he did the same thing with the Great American Songbook here. And then finally, we got out of nowhere last year, Rough and Rowdy Ways was released. And again, it kind of almost reminds me of a sequel to Tempest, but it was a fantastic album. In fact, Tempest and Rough and Rowdy Ways were really good. But Rough and Rowdy Ways has got this haunting quality, and it almost sounds like a kind of sign-off or elegy for the 20th century. You know, it's filled with allusions, and it just feels like the end of an era. And like, he's trying to channel all of American history into himself before it's all lost forever type thing. Very, very interesting album. Okay. So let me just check to see if the chat is still listening to me. Yes. Somebody saying AAC's trilogy everywhere. Is it a truism? I actually do think that there are distinct. These three albums here are definitely a trilogy. Blood on the Tracks, Desire, and Street Legal are definitely a trilogy. These three albums are a trilogy. And Love and Theft, Modern Times, and Together Through Life form a trilogy, without doubt. I mean, Tempest and Rough and Rowdy Ways feel like they go together. These three albums are definitely a trilogy too, because they're all on the same theme. So, yes. Now, where shall I begin? How shall I do this? Shall I go through every single album here? Somebody's now defending Be Here Now. I just remember that the press went a bit overboard on Be Here Now, you know. All right. So where should we start? I'm going to very quickly go through each album. And I actually wrote a guide to Dylan about a decade ago, which I've got open here in a side tab. I'm just going to see what I said about it, you know, 8-9 years ago, and then I'll see if I've got anything to add today, okay? So I wrote, the most striking thing about Bob's overlooked debut is how aggressive and full of proto-punkish energy it is. His guitar playing is fierce. He takes a lot of these blues standards and chews them up and spits them out to create something truly radical for 1962. And like nothing else released at the time at all. The highlights here are the faster numbers, such as Fixing to Die and Highway 61 Blues. Dylan's own writing here is still very much in the Woody Guthrie mode and only gives a hint of the genius that is to come. But this album establishes the fact that, as well as being the most important songwriter of the 20th century, Dylan is also arguably the most important interpreter of blues and traditional folk, which would remain touchstones for the remainder of his career. A truly remarkable debut effort that deserves more time and attention. And I think what I'd add to that is that one of the things that I like to do, because there's a very strange thing that Dylan does. He's a very prolific writer, and he's a very prolific recorder of material when he makes albums. So every album tends to have a lot of outtakes, okay, and a lot of stuff that he recorded for the session that then wasn't used on the album for whatever reason. But unusually, Dylan, and I don't know why this is, doesn't always have the greatest track selection. Like, he doesn't, sometimes he leaves off songs that are easily as good as anything off the album. In fact, arguably, Dylan's outtakes, that is his rough cuts and his throwaways, taken all together, are actually better than most, I would say 90% of artists' actual proper output, if that makes any sense. And I wish I was hyperbolizing there, but I'm not. This is the bootleg series. And if you're really going to become a fan, I would get acquainted with this series. This one, the Bootleg Series Volume 1 to 3, is an absolute must buy if you're into Dylan at all. And you can see here, the first five tracks are the outtakes from the first album. And I really like House Carpenter, for example. He was a friend of mine. All of these songs, No More Auction Block, has got that kind of punkish energy I was talking about. So, I would definitely check out those five tracks as well as what's on this first album here. It's the speed with which he plays. I mean, you can compare what other folk guys were doing in 1962, and it doesn't sound anything like this. So, you know, there is a proto-punk energy, I would say, on the first album. So let's move on to the next one in the interest of time, because then we have Freewheeling Bob Dylan. Now, I was so into Dylan at one point that somebody actually bought me this jacket that looked very similar to this. And I remember that me and my girlfriend at the time actually tried to recreate this cover exactly, because, you know, I also have curly hair like that as well. So we tried to recreate this cover in New York at the time when I had this suede jacket. So that was something. I also remember massively same person I was with. We went to New York. We were there for a week or something. And we took a whole day out because I insisted on going to see Masked and Anonymous, the film with Bob Dylan in it. And there's one little cinema showing it somewhere in New York. And I was like, right, I'm going to go there. She was pretty pissed off with all of that. But anyway, so this is really where the idea of Bob Dylan as this genius songwriter comes to the fore, because, you've got Masters of War, which is a big anti-war protest song. And again, if you listen to that, one of the things that I think Dylan has that a lot of the protest songwriters around this time, who for my money are a bit didactic, they're a bit on the nose, they're a little bit cringy, they're a little bit preachy and left wing. If you listen to Dylan, this song Masters of War could have been written yesterday, could have been written 100 years ago, could have been written 200 years ago. There's a kind of timeless quality to a lot of the way that he puts these things. Blowing in the Wind, of course. You know, it's kind of non-specific, and he's generally talking in this way. You know, he kind of sounds like a prophet, but there's enough ambiguity in what he's saying that, yes, all of these things could be co-opted by the countercultural movement and the protest stuff that was going on at that time, and he was part of that scene. But it was kind of also non-specific in a way that, if you listen to Pete Seeger or any of these other chaps, they're a bit more, I guess, consciously on the nose when it comes to what they're talking about. Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, all time great song. It's got this, refrain of the hard rain falling. And this is another one of the touchstones of Dylan's songwriting, where he's got this kind of almost biblical apocalyptic refrain of a hard rain falling, and the music drives and it sounds like hard rain is falling. And then another hallmark of Dylan's songwriting is lists. Like he loves kind of piling up images in lists like this. You know, I saw a new born baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men, their hammers are bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And you can see how this is like, you can fill in what he's talking about if you were there in 1963. But it doesn't necessarily have to be about that, because his language is so alive, but also has this timeless quality. And it also has this biblical quality somehow. It's just like the, you know, the images he chooses feel like they come out of scripture. Okay. I mean, we can go to the next verse. You know, I hear the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve. I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. Hard rain's going to fall. So yeah, I mean, this incessant driving, piling up of images is something that Dylan does a lot. Another hallmark of his songwriting that is here right at the start. I mean, he develops it and he obviously matures as a writer as time goes on, is the kind of, there's an almost surreal, whimsical nature to how these images are disconnected. There's a lot of kind of, I guess, non sequitur shifts that you get where you're, you know, you've got one profound image in your mind and he's already hitting you with something that on the face of it is completely unrelated. And that's something that he does a lot as well. It's one of the hallmarks of his writing. So yeah, Don't Think Twice, of course. Great. I mean, this is a great album, Freewheeling Bob Dylan. And again, you'll typically see it being given 5 stars. Now there is some material that was left off this. I mentioned talking John Birch Paranoid Blues. I think that was deliberately left off the album because it was seen to be too controversial at the time. The John Birch Society complained, so that was the record label at that time didn't want to put that on. So he didn't put that on. But all of these songs, Quit Your Low Down Ways, it's got that, again, that, you see that Bible thumping vibe is there right from the start in Dylan. And Quit Your Low Down Ways is a song that gets to that. There's also a lot of, I mean, it must be said, there's a lot of tales here of mistreatment of black people, I suppose, or songs of like people being hung or, you know, various different, perceived injustices and things. So while I would never say that Dylan was a social justice warrior of any, you know, in any respect, he does touch on some of those themes on these early albums. Whether it comes naturally to him or not is another question, but he does have songs like that on there. So, maybe on the next album, if we shift to the times they are changing, the Ballad of Hollis Brown certainly is a song about, a victim, I guess. But again, it's played so well and the imagery is so, you know, bloody and vivid that, it does have a power. What did I say about times they are a-changing 8 or 9 years ago? What did I say about freewheeling, first of all? Shall I read out what I said about freewheeling? I forgot. Okay, so in freewheeling, I said, it's almost impossible to comprehend how Dylan was 21 here. This was the album that was seized upon by the zeitgeist to make Dylan the voice of a generation, a tag he would struggle with and come to despise in subsequent years. The front cover is one of the all-time best. The songwriting is peerless and a lesson in how to do politics by staying away from specifics and yet getting at themes that seem forever apposite. Blowing in the Wind and Masters of War are songs that capture the mood of the early counterculture and also distill the political anger of youth. The towering masterpieces at the center of this album, though, are A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, with its pileup of vivid imagery and its driving anger and passion, The Sound of the Coming Apocalypse, and Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, the first of many terrific breakup songs that Dylan would write. There are other songs here, for example, Talking World War III Blues, that are mere imitations of Woody Guthrie. Others, such as Bob Dylan's Dream, start to show Dylan's more surreal side, which he would continue to explore in the mid-60s. This is an album that rests on its five or six killer songs, though, which were so different and so far ahead of anything else happening in 1963 that it is easy to see why Dylan became a talisman for an entire political and cultural movement at that time. So even back 8 or 9 years ago, yours truly could still write a paragraph, friends. Let's see what I said about the times they are changing. Okay, I said, Bob doesn't look happy on the front cover of this album. He looks troubled. He looks strained. He doesn't quite look himself. Perhaps that is because this is the only time in his career that he did the album that people would expect of him. He was given the mantle, the voice of a generation, and this was the album that people expected of him. The political songwriting is, again, pretty amazing. The title track is an almost irresistible and massive FU to the previous generation and to conservative attitudes. And it was a lightning rod for the counterculture movement. Dylan also channels some of the energy and anger of his first album for two really amazing songs, The Ballad of Hollis Brown and The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. But this album is very earnest, grim and humorless in a way that suggests that Dylan wasn't altogether comfortable with the mantle thrust upon him. It doesn't mean, and this does mean that this album can veer into boring territory, with God on our side and only a pawn in their game, feel like written to order sequels to Masters of War. Of all of Dylan's albums, this is perhaps the most of its time. It's still very good, but in a way, the front cover tells you most of the story here. And as time has gone on, I would say I agree with what I said back there. I also wonder about the extent to which this was and the FU that I claimed it was, because he's channeling into something that was happening at the time. And that's what great artists do. They act as a conduit for something that's in the ether. And it's undeniable that something in the air was changing in the early 60s there. And if you think about the lyrics of Times They Are A-Changing, he's saying that there's change coming here. The order is rapidly fading. It's happening. So, yeah, I do wonder about how that was meant at the time. Because if you watch interviews and if you see Dylan in this period, he's not, he's hostile to the media and he's hostile to interviewers and things like that. But he's never keen to be seen as a political activist or anything like that. This would reach its head on another side of Bob Dylan. I'll read what I said 10 years ago here. Recorded in one long drunk-fueled session, so that the whole album was done in one night, basically. This is Dylan finally telling his Legion followers, who treated him as a political leader, to bugger off. As the title suggests, this is showing off his various sides: romantic, playful, silly, even selfish and resentful. Spanish Harlem Incident is one of the great overlooked Dylan songs, almost a perfect love song. To Ramona is also a classic. The Chimes of Freedom is one of his better political songs. And then the surrealism that was hinted at continues on I Shall Be Free number 10 and the Motorcycle Nightmare. These are kind of, like talking dreams in a way. There are, however, two of my least favorite songs on the album, which are My Back Pages and Ballad in Plain D. I am not a fan of those. And again, this is still, I think, Dylan working through this early, earnest, kind of joyless period and trying to find himself rather than the the kind of prophet that the folk crowd wanted him to be. You know, so I think they're quite dreary, and they drag down the album in a way. However, the last track, which is It Ain't Me, Babe, is one of the best songs on the album and one of the best that Dylan would ever write. You can take it as a straight breakup song. It's full of devastating lines. But of course, you could also take It Ain't Me, Babe, as having the dual function of telling his followers that he's not that political leader or icon that they're looking for. And that's just the first of many times that Dylan would appear to turn his back on his fans. And we'll have a look at some of the lyrics of It Ain't Me, Babe. He says, "Go away from my window, leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone, never weak but always strong, to protect you and defend you whether you're right or wrong. It ain't me, babe." So, I mean, like I said, you can take it as a straight love song, but I think it's obvious that he's also telling the folksters that, especially with the flowers imagery, you know, who knows who he's talking about? I mean, some people say he's talking to Joan Baez, and other people have got different theories, but it's obvious to me that he's saying, like, listen, this chapter, Dylan the protest man, Dylan the kind of folk hero is dead. Okay, so all right, so let's carry on, because I need to get a move on here if we're going to get anywhere through all of these albums. Now we have Bringing It All Back Home, stone cold masterpiece. Here's what I said 10 years ago. My de facto favorite album by anyone for over a decade now. This is his first album to include an electric side, and cries of Judas from the folk purists in the tour that followed are now the stuff of legend. Subterranean Homesick Blues and Maggie's Farm shift Dylan's writing from the political to the social. She Belongs to Me and Love Minus Zero are textbook examples of near-perfect economic writing, the latter arguably in the top five songs he would write. It is a masterpiece. Then there's a sort of break in the album, some obligatory and welcome blues numbers, and another surreal adventure in Bob Dylan's 115th Dream. From there, the final four acoustic songs are as good as any four songs found in a sequence on any album, and probably better. They are notable for how different each of them are as well. Mr. Tambourine Man feels like an ode to weed, as its images swirl and bore their way into your mind. Gates of Eden is stately, majestic, almost pompous, but surreal and almost self-mocking all at the same time. One of his more underrated songs, in my view, probably the apex of his tendency towards unlikely and complex images in this period of his songwriting. And this is something that we'll see as we go towards Blonde on Blonde, increasing complexity of imagery, which then he completely pares back and pares down when we get to John Wesley Harding. He completely changes his songwriting style from 1967 onwards. Now, It's All Right, Ma is a song for the ages, and it has an audacious stanzaic structure. I'll just get up. It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding, because it has, you know, what's the audacious structure I picked up on? The rhyme scheme. A-A-A-A-A, B, C-C-C-C-C, B, D-D-D-D-D, B. So the end of every stanza here rhymes with the end of every last one, but it's preceded by four other lines that rhyme all with themselves. So darkness at the break of noon, shadows even the silver spoon, the handmade blade, the child's balloon, eclipses both the sun and moon. To understand you knew too soon, there's no sense in trying. Pointed threats they bluff with scorn, suicide remarks are torn from the fool's gold piece, mouse piece, the hollow horn. Play wasted words prove to warn that he not busy born is busy dying. And you can see that there's a cadence and a meter to the way he's written this line, these lines that build the momentum as you're getting to the clinching final verse here. There are some brilliant lines on this. You know, he not busy being born is busy dying. even the president of the United States sometimes must have to stand naked, a line that always gets a kind of round of applause at live gigs if you ever go. How about this passage here? Advertising signs, they con you into thinking you're the one that can do what's never been done, that can win what's never been won. Meantime, life outside goes on all around you. Or how about this one? For them that must obey authority, that they do not respect in any degree, who despise their jobs, their destinies, speak jealously of them that are free, cultivate their flowers to be nothing more than something they invest in. I mean, you know, how about while money doesn't talk, it swears? When I first heard this song, It's All Right Ma, at the age of 18, it blew my mind. And in a way, it continues to blow my mind now. This was me writing 10 years ago. There are weak lines here and there, but it feels like the greatest song ever written whenever I hear it. It's absolutely fantastic. The fact that it's probably not as strong as Love Minus Zero or the final song on this album, which is another devastating breakup song, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, probably the best breakup song ever written, tells you everything that you need to know about this album. I couldn't praise it more if I tried. It's an album that's so good, I've come to the point where I believe it justifies its own filler, which is the blues numbers and the dream track. You almost need a break from hearing songs that are this exquisitely crafted and so passionately performed. So I really think that Dylan hit his stride here with Bring It All Back Home. And if you're paying attention at home, you can asterisk those albums that are, I mean, when it comes to Dylan, lots of his albums are five stars on normal kind of mortal things, but then there are other albums that are even a cut above again. This is one to put an asterisk by. This is an all-timer. Okay, so I don't know, give it six stars or something. All right, let's move on because I need to get to Highway 61 Revisited, another absolute banger. In fact, before we get there, I should probably mention this album here. Can I open it? I don't know why it's not opening for me. How can I get it to it? Oh, here we go. All right, so famously, there was a gig that he did at the Manchester Trade Hall that came to be known as the Royal Albert Hall concert. The reason it was known as the Royal Albert Hall concert is because bootleggers were trading the tapes, and whoever it was that copied it erroneously wrote down that it was the Royal Albert Hall concert. But in fact, it happened at the Manchester Trade Hall. And this is one of the all-time famous gigs in history because Dylan played the first half acoustic, just like on his earlier stuff, he played it acoustic. And then in the second half, he basically brought out electric instruments, electric guitar, and the crowd, who were folk purists, became hostile, and they started booing and heckling and jeering. And famously, there's a moment where there's a guy who shouts out Judas. They call him a Judas. And, Dylan turns around and says to his band, you know, play fucking loud. And then they burst into the track. I think it's actually Visions of Johanna that happens on, but I could be wrong there. But yeah, that's one of the all-time kind of legendary moments in rock history that is mythologized, and it's captured on Bootleg Series 4. So that's important to know that, you know, what was happening. And really, Dylan started to pick up like a slightly different following with this. He'd left behind the kind of folk scene, and he was starting to do like rock, basically, or what people call folk rock. And so Highway 61, if I can just, I don't know how to get this. Okay, you have to click on the image. Highway 61 really is the next step. The whole album is electric this time. There's no acoustic numbers. And It has arguably his most famous song, Like a Rolling Stone, one of my favorite songs, Tombstone Blues. And he's so angry and snarling on this album. There's a lot of pent up kind of anger, young man anger on this album. Let me see what I wrote 10 years ago. This album showcases Dylan at his angriest and most vital. Some of the nastiest and most contemptuous songs ever written are on here, such as Like a Rolling Stone, which is often considered the best song ever written, Queen Jane Approximately, and Ballad of a Thin Man. I mean, Ballad of a Thin Man is, when I said he doesn't like critics, he doesn't like professors and things. I mean, who is this directed at when he says something's happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? Walk into the room with your pencil in your hand. You see somebody naked. You say, who is that man? You try so hard, but you just don't understand just what you say when you'll get home. He's talking about the journalist, I think, who's trying to get a grip on what's happening. There we go. There's a genuine contempt, I guess, for a certain type of conformist normie on this album. When he says you've been with the professors and they've all liked your looks. With great lawyers, you've discussed lepers and crooks. You've been through all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's books. You're very well read. It's well known. So, that there is he does seem to have a disdain for that certain kind of strata of intelligentsia, and he's never had any time for them, which I find interesting. What else did I say? Where Dylan's playfulness on an album like Another Side of Bob Dylan is a young man messing about, here his playfulness is always laced with sneering sarcasm and the sort of punkish rebelliousness that hadn't been shown before. I mean, it's hinted on that first album, but it really comes into its own here on Highway 61. God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. 7 out of the 9 songs on this album are bona fide masterpieces. Tombstone Blues is the apotheosis of the arc of surreal songwriting he mined in the acoustic half of the previous album. Desolation Row is inarguably his best epic track. From a Buick 6 is better than the average blues throwaway filler track from this period. I think he is at the peak of his creative powers here when he can just throw out a verse like this as if it was nothing. When you're lost in the rain in Juarez and it's Easter time too, and your gravity fails and negativity don't pull you through, don't put on any airs when you're down on Rue Morgue Avenue. They've got some hungry women there and they really make a mess out of you. But the strength and the maturity of the writing only tells half of the story, because it's the performances that make a lot of these songs. And this is why I think the people who want to take Dylan as only a poet or only a literary figure are missing a lot. These songs have to be listened to in performance. The performance is part of it. These songs don't live on the page. They live in performance. Dylan's often said that he's a song and a dance man. You must listen to the record. And, those people who say, well, Dylan can't sing, his songs are better done by somebody else. Absolute bollocks. Nobody else can be by turns snarling, vicious, arch, fed up, bileful, remorseless. He gets across all of those things within the space of a few lines. And, it wouldn't have the same venom if the fucking Birds did the song. Do you understand? It loses a lot when it's somebody else. So I have never been one of these people who has any time for the notion that Dylan is better covered. No, he's not. Dylan is always best on it. I'm one of the few people in the world who thinks All Along the Watchtower is better done by Dylan than Jimi Hendrix. The song loses something in the Hendrix version. Dylan's version sounds like a bloody time capsule from the 17th century. So anyway, This has got to be the ultimate album for any young man who feels like he's just had enough of the world. The only way this album could be better if the single Positively 4th Street had been included. And Positively 4th Street was a single that was brought out around this time. Was it on Greatest Hits? Yeah, it's Positively 4th Street. I mean, you've got a lot of nerve to say you are my friend. When I was down, you just stood there grinning. Where's the... this is so much bile on this song. I wish that for just one time you could stand inside my shoes, and just for that moment I could be you. Yes, I would just wish for just one time you could stand inside my shoes, you'd know what a drag it is to see you. I mean, so Positively 4th Street is a kind of, you know, you should remember that, and that will be on Sidetracks if you take my recommendation and, you know, go through these albums with Sidetracks kind of as a companion piece. All right, so let's get on to Blonde on Blonde. We're making decent time. We're making decent time. Here's Blonde on Blonde. So the third part of the Holy Trilogy, again, bona fide classic, knockout, five star, blah, blah, blah. What did I say 10 years ago? Dylan sounds markedly wearier on this album than its fiery predecessor. This is him in his coffee-fueled, coked-out hipster poet phase. His voice sounds deeper and more strained, and the music has a sound all of its own. As Dylan himself once described it, that thin, that wild mercury sound, it's metallic and bright gold. It's bluesier than Highway 61, and it traverses a wider range of emotions. Some of the songs here are exquisite, like Visions of Johanna. I mean, talk about the songwriting. Let's just have a look at some of the lyrics on Visions of Johanna. It's just ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet? We sit here stranded, though we're all trying our best to deny it. And Louise holds a handful of rain, tempting you to defy it. Yeah. So, my favorite part of this song is a little bit later. What does he say? Is it on this song? I think it is. See if I can find it. That's it. The howls of the ghost of electricity howled in the bones of her face. Where were these visions of Johanna have now taken place? I mean, it's just amazing. Just really, really exquisite writing on this song and throughout this album. Anyway, some of the songs here are exquisite. Visions of Johanna, I Want You, with their swirling imagery, beautiful poetic lines, contenders for some of his best that he would ever write. One of Us Must Know, and Most Likely You'll Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine, are very good entries into the pantheon of great Dylan breakup tracks. And again, that Most Likely You'll Go Your Way has got a bit of that kind of snarling attitude from the previous album as well. All of the songs demonstrate someone still, as with the last album, at the peak of his powers. However, for whatever reason, I find myself listening to this one less than his other classic albums. Why? First is the length. This was one of the very first four-sided LPs. I find that the album drags from Temporary Like Achilles onwards. And secondly, and this will be sacrilegious to some fans, I am not really a fan of the 11-minute sad-eyed lady of the lowlands. Make no mistake, though, this is one of the absolute best albums, so you should make your own mind up about it. But it, for whatever reason, it's never been one of my favorites, Blonde on Blonde, even though, you know, it is, I mean, absolute peak Dylan, like I said. So, all right. So after this, as I mentioned, he has the motorcycle accident. And when he comes back, he brings out this mysterious, quiet, enigmatic album, John Wesley Harding. Here's what I said 10 years ago. Bob had a much publicized motorcycle accident after Blonde on Blonde came out, in which some say he almost died. Some people at that time thought he might not make another album until the extent of his injuries were known. Musically and artistically, Dylan was on the monster run of all monster runs, with every album since Freewheeling hailed as a masterpiece by music fans in the know and critics. Note, however, that folk purists hated everything after Another Side Of, but the wider music world, you know, he was on a monster run, regularly charting in the top 10. His direction until now has been towards ever-increasing complexity. So a grand total of zero people on earth could have predicted that he would come out of his post-accident retreat with this quiet, minimalist, stripped-down album of songs that sound like they come from a bygone age. And, you know, there are very few albums that make me feel like this, but John Wesley Harding always makes me feel like I'm the only person on the earth listening to it. It just sounds like something from another time. Most of the songs, with the exception of the Ballad of Frankie Lee and Judas Priest, are also over in three short verses. And very, very unusually for rock lyrics, all of the songs are rhymed A-B. Let me just show the title track to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, rhyming A-B. John Wesley Harding was a friend to the poor. He traveled with a gun in every hand. All along the countryside, he opened many a door, but he was never known to hurt an honest man. So there it is, A-B, A-B, A-B. You've got a harmonica, you've got Bob's vocal, you've got a bass guitar, you've got a steel guitar and an acoustic guitar, and that's it. So this is a exercise in amazingly economic songwriting, the sort of which he'd hinted at on Bringing It All Back Home with She Belongs to Me and Love Minus Zero. All Along the Watchtower, amazing, of course, The Wicked Messenger, I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine, and the title track are all exemplary of this kind of economic songwriting. All of the songs have an obliquely biblical feel and sound. There is only one eminently skippable track here, in my view, and that is Dear Landlord, which is a lament at his old manager, Albert Grossman, for ripping him off. That is too dreary for me to sit through most of the time. I mean, I tend to skip through Dear Landlord. However, apart from that, John Wesley Harding is probably one of the coolest albums ever recorded. Quiet, restrained, enigmatic, unusual, profound sounding, remote, oddly archaic. It always feels like you're the only person on the earth. See, even back then, I was saying the same thing. Always feels like you're the only person on earth to be listening to it. The final two tracks are a little more country tinged, and that was hint towards what was to come around the corner. John Wesley Harding, one of my favorites. And again, a bona fide five-star effort, of course. Let's just have a little look at All Along the Watchtower, because that is a fantastic piece of songwriting. One of the things to appreciate about this is that it's only, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 lines long, All Along the Watchtower, okay? The song starts with the Joker and the thief arriving, okay? And it ends with two riders approaching. So the song is in a constant loop. It ends as it started. So it's an endless cycle, kind of a cyclical view of time, which is really interesting. And again, like where is this, where there are jokers and thieves riding around, and just this, the language, you know, businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. And people have speculated, like, who's the Joker, who's the thief. Some people have thought it's Christ. Other people have got other ideas of what this song is about. So it's sublimely enigmatic as well. All Along the Watchtower, princes kept the view. All the women came and went. Barefoot Servants 2. And like I said, I prefer this album, this version from Dylan, to the Hendrix version and any other version that anybody's done. I think Dylan did it best. Even Dylan, I think, said he liked Hendrix's one, but I think Dylan's was best. So press a one in the chat. Press a one in the chat if you agree that Dylan's All on the Watchtower is better than Hendrix's, and press a two in the chat if you think it's Hendrix, and I will use your answer to judge you. So let's see. Yes. Paul Johnson calling you out, son. I hate those twos. So there you go. People saying the two. All right. Let's carry on then with Nashville Skyline. This is his Unexpected Country album, which was, I think, heavily hinted at the end of John Wesley Harding. Johnny Cash actually turns up here to do a cover of Dylan's own song, Girl from a North Country, which was back on Freewheeling, of course. And Nashville Skyline, again. I mean, while a turn towards country is hinted at on the final two tracks of John Wesley Harding, few could have predicted a fully-fledged country album replete with a new crooner voice in 1967. Yes, Dylan's voice on Nashville Skyline is unlike any other voice that he uses. He's got this kind of crooner vocal that he uses just for this one album, which is hilarious, which makes it kind of unique in his back catalogue. While the most striking thing about this album is the change in the sound, this signals a new turn towards simplicity and away from complexity, and away from the complexity of his Holy Trinity of the mid-60s. While John Wesley Harding has that stripped-down, stark, economic soundwriting, there's still quite a dense layering of imagery here, there on John Wesley Harding. Whereas here, Dylan starts writing incredibly simple and earnest love songs. There are five tight and great songs in this mode here. To Be Alone With You, I Threw It All Away, the great single, Lay, 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 Lay Across My Big Brass Bed, the strikingly sincere, Tell Me That It Isn't True, and Tonight I'll Be Staying Here With You. These songs feel effortless and easy, but they are never schmaltzy or too saccharine. In fact, Paul McCartney spent a massive chunk of his solo career in this sort of territory, but I'm not sure that he ever managed to get the balance as pitch perfect as Dylan manages here. McCartney sometimes can be too saccharine, sometimes can be schmaltzy, whereas somehow Dylan manages to toe that line here where it never kind of quite tilts over. There are also incredibly light and silly fun numbers on the album, like Nashville Skyline Rag, One More Night, and Country Pie. The only dud here, in my view, and this will be, again, controversial with Dylan fans, is the superfluous version of Freewheeling's Girl from a North Country with Johnny Cash, which is not the knockout team-up that you'd hope for. I think when you have, like, two towering figures like Dylan and Cash, you know, it's just too much for one record, you know. People who are not into Dylan have some odd perceptions about him, right? There are some really odd things that, you know, Dylan's serious, that he's miserable, that he's depressing. Nonsense. That he can't sing, that he's always political, that he's a protest writer. All of that is utter crap that comes from ignorance. The truth is that Dylan gives you a song for every mood, every occasion, every stage of life. And this album, Nashville Skyline, is like a comforting hug and a silly smile. It's relaxed and it's cozy. You can look at the ever serious, greatest of all time type artists, and a lot of them get too caught up with perceptions of cool or of their own legacy. Can any of them offer up something like this? Can you imagine Leonard Cohen making Nashville Skyline? or Lou Reed or David Bowie or even Neil Young. None of them have an album like Nashville Skyline. But you know what? This kind of fun side is as much an important part of life as anything else. And why not? Nashville Skyline completes a run of albums that arguably has yet to be matched by anyone. And the album is routinely given 5 stars by critics. My rating is no different. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, depending on how you rate these albums, he's been on the run of all runs here. I mean, from Freewheeling to this, there's no, you know, even from the first album to this, you know, absolutely stellar lineup in the 60s. So, Nashville Skyline, fantastic. I think the reason that Dylan does these things, whereas, you know, none of those other people I mentioned, is that in a way, they're all too conscious of themselves. Even Bowie is conscious of himself, too aware of what's going on. Whereas Dylan, in my view, never really gives a shit what's going on. It's just in his own world, always. Just does what he wants. And, you know, when everybody else is making, like, you know, super deluxe concept albums, Dylan brings out Nashville Skyline, just does his own thing. And, you know, it depends on how you define these things. But according to one definition, that is the definition of based, is it not? The definition of based is you're just prepared to be yourself. Just to be who you are, make no apologies for it. And that's what I think Dylan does consistently in his career. And Nashville Skyline is probably the ultimate example where, you know, you had all that San Francisco stuff going on and he just retreats and makes this little album here instead. Okay, then we have Self-Portrait. Not too much to say about this one. It's arguably his first kind of quote-unquote bad album. What did I write? So I said that there's a lot of stories about this album. Dylan was sick of being claimed as the voice of his generation. He was burned out. That he released the album to get the record off his back, that he released it to get rid of unwanted fans. But never mind any of that. Is Self-Portrait any good? That's the real question. And the answer is, annoyingly, yes and no. On the one hand, it's obviously not even close to the 9 albums that preceded it. And it shows off, if anything, that not everybody can produce greatness all the time. And, you know, I would say that when Dylan is bad, he can be pretty shit as well. There's certainly some bad stuff. On the other hand, however, Self-Portrait is not totally shit either. There's a critic called Robert Christgau, with whom I don't always agree. But he has perhaps the most interesting take that I've seen on Self-Portrait. Christgau writes, conceptually, this is a brilliant album, which is organized, I think, by 2 central ideas. First, that self is most accurately defined and depicted in terms of the artifacts, in this case, pop tunes and folk songs, claimed as personal property and semi-spontaneous renderings of past creations frozen for posterity on a piece of tape, and perhaps even a couple of songs one has written oneself to which one responds. Second, that people's music is the music the people's like, Mantovi strings and all. His problem is that the music doesn't hold up to the concept, and that is undoubtedly true. One problem is that the pacing of the songs and the instrumentation are much too languid. Something like the cover of Tampa Red's It Hurts Me Too, which is a great song if you listen to the Tampa Red original, somehow Bob manages to suck the life out of it. There's a cover of Paul Simon's The Boxer, and it's shite. I mean, put it frankly, it's shite. There's a pointless version of Like a Rolling Stone on here. Another problem is that there are too many throwaways. It's too long, too much filler. And despite all of that, there are highlights. All the Tired Horses with its female vocalists is a kind of curiosity. Days of 49 would be thought of more highly if it was on a different album. And his performance of Quinn the Eskimo, the Mighty Quinn, from the Isle of Wight Festival is included on Self-Portrait. And that is awesome. That version of the Mighty Quinn shits all over the basement tapes version. Anyway, I'd recommend listening to those three and then not coming this back to this album until you listen to at least 25 others. Okay, so it looks like we are, we are at the end of the decade of the 60s here, and I've already gone almost 2 hours. So I'm wondering whether I should splice this up and make a part two and part three, because we're simply not going to get through everything here. So I might call an audible, check the super chats, get out of here, and then come back, you know, to do a part two. What do we think? What do we do? Maybe I'll do, yeah, because I feel like new portrait. Maybe I'll do new portrait and the songs on the greatest hits, and that probably marks the end of this chapter of Dylan, and then we can pick up with the 70s next time. Unfortunately, because there's too much. There's just too much Dylan to get through. Okay. I mean, yeah, somebody's saying the gospel episodes, gospel years deserve an entire, yeah. Everybody says I should do part two. Okay. So let's just do New Morning. This is where Dylan went to a kind of farm and tried to hang out with his kids and stuff. Lovely album. Lovely, lovely album. I'll talk about that. And then I'll do the super chats and get out of here. Okay. So this is more like the follow-up to Nashville Skyline that you would have hoped for, even though he's mostly ditched the crooner voice of Nashville Skyline to the more familiar nasal tones that we all know and love. This album finds Dylan hitting his 30s, retreating to family life, famously to a farm in North Dakota. And I think that this is one of the more interesting facets of Dylan, right? Where, you know, the media elites in LA and New York disdain the flyover country. They disdain the rural life. They disdain small town America. I mean, you could look at Hollywood representations of small town America to see their utter disdain for the countryside, for the rural areas of the country, redneck America. Dylan, on the other hand, almost does the opposite. You know, he set off on the road to find Woody Guthrie when he was 16, gave himself a new identity, gave himself a new name. Like, he came from a pretty middle-class Jewish family, but he seems to have kind of shed that identity and kind of tried to craft his own image in a way. He's like a kind of self-made, and that's very American if you think about it, the idea of the self-made man, the individual, you know, the person who makes up his own backstory. This is part of the kind of Dylan mythology. And they talk about how, you know, when he was a young man, when he was 16, 17, 18, he'd meet 10 different people and maybe give each one of them a different origin story. You know, completely made up backstory. So, you know, part of Dylan is always the kind of wearing these different masks as well, I guess. But I would say that by this time, like, he's been doing that for a decade. And in a way, he imbibes or he takes in a lot of that country that he sees traveling through it. You know, unlike most people who live in New York or LA or, you know, in London, say, he sees a lot more of the everyday America, you know, of middle America, of redneck America, of small town America. And he doesn't, unlike Bruce Springsteen or, some of those later guys, he doesn't sneer at that in the same way. There is a certain type of person that Dylan sneers at, but it always feels like he's sneering at the person who wants to be respectable in the eyes of the establishment, or somebody who wants to be respectful in the eyes of everybody else. A kind of NPC character, a kind of middle class midwit, intellectual type. These always seem to be the targets of Dylan's vitriol when he's really having a go. He never really has a go at kind of Joe Average in that way, I don't think. And when you see some of his life choices, you know, he chooses to retreat to this farm. He chooses a kind of rural life for a while in North Dakota. And, you know, I would say this album is another exhibit for that. There is a Dylan album and song for every occasion and for every feeling, because this is a song about a young man or a guy in his 30s trying to establish a home base for himself. You know, he's got love songs for his wife, sweet songs like If Not For You. Obviously, George Harrison has got a famous version of that as well. I think George Harrison was always a good friend of Bob Dylan's, and Dylan just said, yeah, have this one, basically. New Morning is a lovely song, One More Weekend. And then he's got like these scenes of family life, domesticity. You know, Sign on the Window is a beautiful song. Time Passes Slowly, Winterlude, where it's he's kind of, you know, chopping trees in the wintertime. The Man in Me, you know, he talks about what it's like to be a father on this album. And then he has a number of kind of, so he has this, what's interesting about New Morning is he sets up this domestic idyll on this farm. And then every once in a while, he has to travel out for some reason. He goes on outings or mental excursions from the family home. And he was trying to retreat from public life. But one of the trips that he has during this time is what I talked about before. He goes to Princeton, you know, the University of Princeton, to collect an honorary degree. And he calls it the Day of the Locusts. And this is what I was talking about. Let's see how he describes, you know, the locusts. You know, he talks about the crowd there. You know, I stepped on the stage to pick up my degree, and the locusts sang in the distance. Yeah, the locusts sang such a sweet melody. The locusts sang in the distance. They were singing for me. I glanced into the chamber. There were judges that were talking. Darkness was everywhere. It smelled like a tomb. I was ready to leave. I was already walking. But the next time I looked, there was a light in the room. The locusts sang, and it gave me a chill. I mean, he didn't want to be there less. He's got like an unusual disdain for these people here. And then he says, look, I put down my robe, picked up my diploma, took hold of my sweetheart. Away we drove, straight for the hills, back to Dakota. I was glad to get out of there alive. Like, he couldn't wait to get from there, you know, out of the university, out of the college town, back to his farm retreat. So, and very much, I would say, like, this comes through strongly, of course, on New Morning. But I would say that is part and parcel of Dylan's mindset pretty much from the start. Like, he never seems that happy in the kind of city environment, which is something he actually shares with Shakespeare, believe it or not. You know, Shakespeare, in all his plays, seems to have a slight disdain for the urbanite, the socialite. You know, his imagination is rural. He wants to get to the small tavern, to the small village or town. You know, and you know, there's a reason for that, because he grew up in the countryside, and it seems like Dylan also has that affinity for the rural area and away from the city. Although he does have like weird little tropes, like whenever he needs to escape, he ends up going to Florida for some reason on a lot of his albums. Like, he's like, he sees Florida as a, you know, he sees the area, or he always talks about being in the Windy City. Like, he's got specific towns for specific things. Anyway, what else? Yeah, there are five. Oh yeah, he's got a song called I Went to See the Gypsy, where he imagines meeting Elvis, who he claims that he's never met. One of his more cryptic and enigmatic songs. I've never really understood Went to See the Gypsy, because apparently he still says he's never met Elvis, and yet that's a whole song about meeting the gypsy Elvis. There are five really good songs on this album. If Not For You is catchy and tender. New Morning finds Dylan full of genuine hope and love, as he describes his new domestic bliss. And again, you must have had moments in life where you feel like this, where you feel like it's kind of a new start, and you're getting away from your old life and you're starting to build again. And, you know, these are things that, you know, at different times, you know, different songs will hit you in different ways, I would say. You know, the people who like get into Dylan when they're a teenager and, you know, love Highway 61, but they never explore later on, you're kind of missing out, because this is an album to listen to when you're a 30 something rather than a 20 something. You're not going to get it if you're 18. You will get it if you're 32 and just started a family, or you know whatever. Sign on the Window is one of the nicest songs he'd ever write. The Man in Me is Bob trying to be a good husband, and The Father of Night is a captivating hint, first hint towards the religious themes that would dominate his writing in the early 80s. New Morning is a great, often overlooked album, and a kind of fitting way to end the decade, I suppose. All right, so we'll end the stream there. Next time we'll hit the 70s. This could easily be a four-parter, folks. Could even be a five-parter, but let's see how much I do next time. We'll hit part two next time and see how far I get. There was a lot of preamble on this one. There was a lot of intro, so maybe I'll get through more stuff next time. We'll do the 70s, 80s, 90s, maybe. We'll see. Okay. So, let's have a look then at Super Chats, and I'll see what people have been saying in the chat, and then we'll get out of here. Seems like nobody used Entropy. I did have Entropy open, but there's nothing in there, so we can skip that. Lovely. I'll just stick it there. Somebody's saying you've done the interesting part. No, I haven't. There's much more interesting stuff to come. I would say you're completely wrong there about that. In fact, I'm probably bigger on 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, recent Dylan than I am even on if Dylan had died here, I wouldn't say the stuff I'd said about him at the start. You know, he has now at this point got a huge, amazing body of work, and to try to just stop in the 60s is such a plebeian, philistine take that I've got nothing but contempt and disdain for people who say things like that. All right, so let us have a look at the super chat, and then we'll get out of here. So M says, what do you think of Rage Against the Machine? Only three albums, but arguably the best political music of a generation. I would recommend Morgoth's essays on Rage Against the Machine, actually. He's got some very good, spicy old essays there, and it gives you an interesting take on Rage Against the Machine. Managerial Elite Toaster says, I ain't complaining about this stream on Bob Dylan. It's a good stream, and many are not. Well, thank you very much, Managerial Elite Toaster. Just Don't Mind says, AA is in the basement mixing up the Nescafe Gold. Yes, thinking about the government. The Mad Mercenary says, I formally request that you watch and do a stream on Africa Addio. It should be mandatory viewing for all teenagers. Best song was All Along the Watchtowers. Is it true that Dylan converted to Islam? No, it isn't. He didn't convert to Islam. Harrison Wade says, do you have anything you secretly enjoy making, or are you a wise consumer librarian? Do you have anything you secretly enjoy making, or are you a wise consumer librarian? What do you mean that I secretly enjoy making? Don't know what he means by that. And Elderman says, why did the cathedral promote Dylan? Interesting question. I think at first it was because he was part of that whole counterculture thing. I also think it's because he was a genuine, you know, I genuinely think that he was that good that, you know, picked up a following and then they couldn't ignore him anymore. I mean, the cathedral did try to turn against, I mean, you say the cathedral, the pop, the kind of music establishment did try to kind of write Dylan off many times in his career. He was written off in 64. He was written off in 67. He was written off in this period I've just talked about now, in 1970. He was you know, so he had many times where he was written off in the Christian period. He was written off in the 80s, pretty much, until Oh Mercy. I mean, you know, this, and there's still a perception. I mean, in some ways, each time he was written off by that, there was a bunch of people who dropped off, of course. You know, I mean, there's a hardcore of Dylan fans, but but I also think that there's an extent to which music journalists love to be seen, like they all like to be seen to not be missing the boat on Dylan. So especially recently, I've noticed that everything seems to get 5 stars these days from rock critics, and I wonder about that, because some of the write-ups I've seen of certain things are, you know, they egregiously miss the mark, and I'm convinced that a lot of the journos don't really know what they're talking about when it comes to Dylan. I do have some books I'd recommend on Dylan that will give you a way into thinking about him, the kind of almost the correct lens with which to approach him, because really to get into, to truly appreciate what he's doing, you need to know some of the traditions he's drawing on. What's that book? There's a book by Michael Gray. Okay. That is the definitive Dylan book by Michael Gray. And it's called Song and Dance Man. Song and Dance Man, The Art of Bob Dylan by Michael Gray. Now, I have dozens and dozens of books on Dylan, books by literary critics like Christopher Ricks, books by, books by all sorts of different people. And the only one that I think truly gets it is Michael Gray. If you can get like Song and Dance Man third, or there may even be a fourth edition now. He also has a book called The Bob Dylan Encyclopedia that's pretty good as well, I would say, because it's everything is steeped, like not just Love and Theft, right from the start. There's so many allusions and references and nods, and, you know, in a way, Dylan is traditional, modernist, and postmodernist all rolled into one. You could say that he's doing something like Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot. You could say that he's postmodern and that he's, you know, everything's a pastiche or everything's, you know, borrowed clothings. But then again, these folk traditions he's drawing on, you know, if you go back to the blues singers of the 20s and 30s, they were constantly doing this. They all, you know, they all had their repertoires and they borrowed from each other, and there was nods and winks. So it's part of the tradition as well. So, All right. I'll just have a look at the normal chat to see if there's any other questions or comments, and then we'll get out of here, I think. Did Dylan board the anti-Trump train? As far as I can see, no. As far as I can see, no. One of the someone says, I can't imagine needing to do homework to appreciate music. Just got nothing but contempt. Did Bob Dylan perform at the POTUS inaugural? I didn't see that. Did he? I don't think he did. Did he? I had a little theory. I mean, we're jumping ahead, but I had a little theory that there was a oblique dig at Obama on the album Tempest. We'll get onto this album next time, but if you have a look at the lyrics of Pay in Blood, he talks about people, like he talks about another politician pumping out the piss, another ragged beggar blowing you a kiss. And I don't know, the lyrics aren't here, but if you actually listen to the record, he says, you know, you've got the same eyes as your mother does. If only you knew who your father was. And a lot of people at that time were, you know, talking about Obama's heritage. So, you know, at that time, it seemed like he was talking about Obama. I would say it's hard. Like, it's hard to get a read on Dylan's politics. He's got one song on Infidels that is pretty Zionist in tone, I would say. In fact, Infidels is pretty, if you ignore the Zionist song, it's got pretty kind of right-wing populist talking points on it. But he's very difficult to nail down when it comes to politics. I know that he was very big on farm, like giving money to farmers, like giving the farm, which is usually a kind of low-key signal for what side you're on of the aisle. But he always keeps that pretty pretty quiet, I would say. Keeps it pretty quiet. Doesn't really talk about that. And I mean, even though there's a straightforwardly Zionist song there, in terms of Dylan's Jewish, specifically Jewish identity, he's tended to play that down. I mean, he was from a fully Jewish background. And I know there, like, some of his kids went to bar mitzvahs and things like that, and he attended them. And I did look. I did try to find, like, he was into some of the Orthodox Jewish groups he's given support to in the past. And when he became a Christian, he was on the evangelical end of the kind of Christian spectrum. But I don't know. My instinct is to say that he has always been low key. His instincts are conservative. You know, he's always like when he critiques society, he's critiquing, it's always the world is falling apart, that with the, you know, the world is being lost. There's so much apocalyptic imagery in his stuff. And it never feels like it's coming from that kind of stereotypically left-wing place, you know, which is not to say, like, I don't know any of his views on economics. I don't know any of his views on politics, but just the sorts of themes that pervade and the sorts of where he tends to position himself, he never feels like a man of the left to me. Even though, of course, popular culture kind of puts him there because he played at that Washington, you know, that famous event that happened with Martin Luther King. I would say, though, that's one issue on which Dylan has always been quite strong, I would say, is on kind of black right. Like, he's always supportive of you know, black people as a group, I would say. And that really comes from his love of the music, the blues especially, and all of the old bluesmen. And you know, there are some interesting essays I've come across that talk about, like, Dylan being part of, like, the what they call the blackification of American folk culture. I think it's a bit much, to be honest. I mean, as far as I can see, he takes from across the spectrum. And that article that I read was a bit of a reach, I think, when it comes to those sorts of things. I mean, if ever there was a guy, he actually converted. If ever there was a person who fully integrated themselves into American culture, whatever that means, it has to be Bob Dylan. I mean, I can't really think of a more American figure. So there it is. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. No, somebody saying that he's a left-wing populist. I mean, I don't know about left-wing, though, because he takes a swipe at unions. He takes a swipe at the, you know, hipster and folk scenes. He never calls for, like, government regulations or big government or anything like that. I don't really see, like, where the left wing, as far as I know, he never talks about gay rights or anything. In his love songs, I would say there's been attempts to call him a misogynist because of his songs like Just Like a Woman, you know, you break just like a little girl. When we get to Street Legal, we'll see a song called Is Your Love in Vain, where he basically is asking the woman to leave him alone in the nighttime. And, you know, what does he say? Can you cook and sew and make flowers grow? There's a song where he straightforwardly says, you know, you should be at home loving a man, basically. So he's pretty traditional when it comes to what he sees as the family unit and family structure. And I don't see any of his political or social commentary as being one that is geared towards breaking down family values or the family unit. The critique never comes from that angle. The critique comes from an angle that wouldn't be out of place in somebody like H.L. Mencken, or, I mean, even an Eveler, you know, because it's always coming from the point of view that, you know, a materialistic, greedy society is stripping away dignity from people, and things are going to the dogs. That's not usually the left wing perspective. So, yeah, I'm not saying that he's straightforwardly left wing or right wing. I'm just saying that it has always felt to me that he's not naturally coming from that kind of social justice or left wing place. It's a much more rooted, almost traditional critique of Western culture, if you want to put it that way. Yeah, I mean, some people disagree, but of course they're wrong, and that's why they're in the chat. I'm here. All right, goodbye everyone, see you next time.